to rich silks and velvets could be found there. An ugly girl should dress in ugly clothing, she decided, so she chose a stained brown cloak fraying at the hem, a musty green tunic smelling of fish, and a pair of heavy boots. Last of all, she palmed her finger knife. There was no haste, so she decided to take the long way round to the Purple Harbour. Across the bridge she went to the Isle of the Gods. Cat of the Canals had sold cockles and mussels amongst the temples here, whenever Brusca's daughter Talia had her moon blood flowing and took to her bed. She half expected to see Talia selling there today, perhaps outside the Warren, where all the forgotten godlings had their forlorn little shrines. But that was silly. The day was too cold, and Talia never liked to wake this early. The statue outside the shrine of the Weeping Lady of Lice was crying silver tears as the ugly girl walked by. In the gardens of Gelenai stood a gilded tree 100 feet high, with leaves of hammered silver. Torchlight glimmered behind windows of leaded glass in the Lord of Harmony's wooden hall, showing 50 kinds of butterflies in all their bright colours. One time, the girl remembered, the sailor's wife had walked her rounds with her and told her tales of the city's stranger gods.
That is the house of the great shepherd. Three-headed Trius has had that tower with three turrets. The first head devours the dying, and the reborn emerge from the third. I don't know what the middle head's supposed to do. Those are the stones to the silent god, and there the entrance to the pattern maker's maze. Only those who learn to walk it properly will ever find their way to wisdom, the priests of the pattern say. Beyond it, by the canal, that's the temple of Aquan, the red bull. Every 13th day his priests slit the throat of a pure white calf and offer bowls of blood to beggars.
Today was not the 13th day, it seemed. The red bull steps were empty. The brother gods, Seamush and Saloso, dreamed in twin temples on opposite sides of the Black Canal, linked by a carved stone bridge. The girl crossed there and made her way down to the docks, then through the Ragman's Harbour and past the half-sunken spires and domes of the drowned town. A group of Lycian sailors were staggering from the happy port as she went by, but the girl did not see any of the whores. The ship was closed up and forlorn, its troop of mummers no doubt still abed. But farther on the wharf, beside an Ebony's whaler, she spied Cat's old friend, Takanaro, tossing a ball back and forth with Casso, king of seals, whilst his latest cut-purse worked the crowd of onlookers. When she stopped to watch and listen for a moment, Takanaro glanced at her without recognition. But Casso barked and clapped his flippers.
"He knows me," the girl thought, "or else he smells the fish."
She hurried on her way. By the time she reached the Purple Harbour, the old man was ensconced inside the soup shop at his usual table, counting a purse of coins as he haggled with the ship's captain. The tall, thin guard was hovering over him. The short, thick one was seated near the door, where he would have a good view of anyone who entered. That made no matter. She did not intend to enter. Instead, she perched atop a wooden piling 20 yards away, as the blustery wind tugged at her cloak with ghostly fingers. Even on a cold grey day like this, the harbour was a busy place. She saw sailors on the prowl for whores, and whores on the prowl for sailors. A pair of bravos passed in rumpled finery, leaning on each other as they staggered drunkenly past the docks, their blades rattling at their sides. A red priest swept past, his scarlet and crimson robes snapping in the wind. It was almost noon before she saw the man she wanted, a prosperous shipowner she had seen doing business with the old man 3 times before. Big and bald and burly, he wore a heavy cloak of plush brown velvet trimmed with fur, and a brown leather belt ornamented with silver moons and stars. Some mishap had left one leg stiff. He walked slowly, leaning on a cane. He would do as well as any, and better than most, the ugly girl decided. She hopped off the piling and fell in after him. A dozen strides put her right behind him, her finger knife poised. His purse was on his right side, at his belt, but his cloak was in her way. Her blade flashed out, smooth and quick, one deep slash through the velvet, and he never felt a thing. Red Rogo would have smiled to see it. She slipped her hand through the gap, slit the purse open with a finger knife, filled her fist with gold. The big man turned.
What?
The movement tangled her arm in the folds of his cloak as she was pulling out her hand. Coins rained round their feet.
Thief!
The big man raised his stick to strike at her. She kicked his bad leg out from under him, danced away, and bolted as he fell, darting past a mother with a child. More coins fell from between her fingers to bounce along the ground. Shouts of "Thief! Thief!" rang out behind her. A pot-bellied innkeep passing by made a clumsy grab for her arm, but she spun around him, flashed past a laughing whore, raced headlong for the nearest alley. Cat of the Canals had known these alleys, and the ugly girl remembered. She darted left, vaulted a low wall, leapt across a small canal, then slipped through an unlocked door into some dusty storeroom. All sounds of pursuit had faded by then, but it was best to be sure. She hunkered down behind some crates and waited, arms wrapped around her knees. She waited for the best part of an hour, then decided it was safe to go, climbed straight up the side of the building and made her way across the rooftops almost as far as the Canal of Heroes. By now the ship owner would have gathered up coins and cane and limped onto the soup shop. He might be drinking a bowl of hot broth and complaining to the old man about the ugly girl who had tried to rob his purse. The kindly man was waiting for her at the House of Black and White, seated on the edge of the temple pool. The ugly girl sat next to him and put a coin on the lip of the pool between them. It was gold, with a dragon on one face and a king on the other.
"The Golden Dragon of Westeros," said the kindly man. "And how did you come by this? We are no thieves." "It wasn't stealing. I took one of his, but I left him one of ours."
The kindly man understood.
"And with that coin and the others in his purse, he paid a certain man. Soon after, that man's heart gave out. Is that the way of it? Very sad."
The priest picked up the coin and tossed it into the pool.
"You have much and more to learn, but it may be you are not hopeless."
That night, they gave her back the face of Arya Stark. They brought a robe for her as well, the soft, thick robe of an acolyte, black upon one side and white upon the other.
"Wear this when you are here," the priest said, "but know that you shall have little need of it for the present. On the morrow you will go to Isambaro to begin your first apprenticeship. Take what clothes you will from the vaults below. The city watch is looking for a certain ugly girl known to frequent the Purple Harbor, so best you have a new face as well."
He cupped her chin, turned her head this way and that, nodded.
"A pretty one this time, I think. As pretty as your own. Who are you, child?"
"No one," she replied.
Arya. She could feel the hole inside her every morning when she woke. It wasn't hunger, though sometimes there was that too. It was a hollow place, an emptiness where her heart had been, where her brothers had lived, and her parents. Her head hurt, too, Not as bad as it had at first, but still pretty bad. Aria was used to that, though, and at least the lump was going down. But the hole inside her stayed the same.
"The hole will never feel any better," she told herself when she went to sleep.
Some mornings Aria did not want to wake at all. She would huddle between her cloak, with her eyes squeezed shut, and try to will herself back to sleep. If the hound would only have left her alone, she would have slept all day and all night. And dreamed. That was the best part, the dreaming. She dreamed of wolves most every night, a great pack of wolves, with her at the head. She was bigger than any of them, stronger, swifter, faster. She could outrun horses and outfight lions. When she bared her teeth, even men would run from her. Her belly was never empty long, and her fur kept her warm even when the wind was blowing cold. And her brothers and sisters were with her, many and more of them, fierce and terrible, and hers. They would never leave her. But if her nights were full of wolves, her days belonged to the dog. Sandor Clegane made her get up every morning whether she wanted to or not. He would curse at her in that raspy voice, or yank her to her feet and shake her. Once he dumped a helmful of cold water all over her head. She bounced up sputtering and shivering and tried to kick him, but he only laughed. "Dry off and feed the bloody horses," he told her, and she did. They had two now, Stranger and a sorrel porphyry mare Aria had named Craven, because Sandor said she'd likely run off from the twins the same as them. They'd found her wandering riderless through a field the morning after the slaughter. She was a good enough horse, but Aria could not love a coward.
Stranger would have fought.
Still, she tended the mare as best she knew. It was better than riding double with a hound. And Craven might have been a coward, but she was young and strong as well. Aria thought she might be able to outrun Stranger, if it came to it. The hound no longer watched her as closely as he had. Sometimes he did not seem to care whether she stayed or went, and he no longer bound her up in a cloak at night.
"One night I'll kill him in his sleep," she told herself,
but she never did.
"One day I'll ride away on Craven, and he won't be able to catch me," she thought,
but she never did that either. Where would she go? Winterfell was gone. Her grandfather's brother was at River Run, but he didn't know her, no more than she knew him. Maybe Lady Smallwood would take her in at Acorn Hall, and maybe she wouldn't. Besides, Aria wasn't even sure she could find Acorn Hall again. Sometimes she thought she might go back to Sharna's Inn, if the floods hadn't washed it away. She could stay with Hutpie, or maybe Lord Beric would find her there. Angai would teach her to use a bow, and she could ride with Gendry and be an outlaw, like Wenda the White Fawn in the songs. But that was just stupid, like something Sansa might dream. Hutpie and Gendry had left her just as soon as they could, and Lord Beric and the outlaws only wanted to ransom her, just like the Hound. None of them wanted her around.
"They were never my pack, not even Hutpie and Gendry. I was stupid to think so. Just a stupid little girl, and no wolf at all."
So she stayed with the Hound. They rode every day, never sleeping twice in the same place, avoiding towns and villages and castles as best they could. Once she asked Sandor Clegane where they were going.
"Away," he said. "That's all you need to know. You're not worth spit to me now, and I don't want to hear your whining. I should have let you run into that bloody castle."
"You should have," she agreed, thinking of her mother.
"You'd be dead if I had. You ought to thank me. You ought to sing me a pretty little song, the way your sister did."
"Did you hit her with an axe too?"
"I hit you with the flat of the axe, you stupid little bitch. If I'd hit you with a blade, there'd still be chunks of your head floating down the Green Fork. Now shut your bloody mouth. If I had any sense, I'd give you to the Silent Sisters. They cut the tongues out of girls who talk too much."
That wasn't fair of him to say.
Aside from that one time, Arya hardly talked at all. Whole days passed when neither of them said anything. She was too empty to talk, and the hound was too angry. She could feel the fury in him. She could see it on his face, the way his mouth would tighten and twist, the looks he gave her. Whenever he took his axe to chop some wood for a fire, he would slide into a cold rage, hacking savagely at the tree or the deadfall or the broken limb until they had 20 times as much kindling and firewood as they needed. Sometimes he would be so sore and tired afterward that he would lie down and go right to sleep without even lighting a fire. Arya hated it when that happened, and hated him too. Those were the nights when she stared the longest at the axe.
"It looks awfully heavy, but I bet I could swing it."
She wouldn't hit him with a flat either. Sometimes in their wanderings they glimpsed other people, farmers in their fields, swineherds with their pigs, a milkmaid leading a cow, a squire carrying a message down a rutted road. She never wanted to speak to them either. It was as if they lived in some distant land and spoke a queer, alien tongue. They had nothing to do with her, or her with them. Besides, it wasn't safe to be seen. From time to time, columns of horsemen passed down the winding farm roads, the twin towers of Frey flying before them.
"Hunting for stray Northmen," the hound said when they had passed. "Any time you hear hooves, get your head down fast. It's not like to be a friend."
One day, in an earthen hollow made by the roots of a fallen oak, they came face to face with another survivor of the twins. The badge on his breast showed a pink maiden dancing in a swirl of silk, and he told them he was Sir Mark Piper's man, a bowman, though he'd lost his bow. His left shoulder was all twisted and swollen where it met his arm. A blow from a mace, he said. It had broken his shoulder and smashed his chainmail deep into his flesh.
"A Northman it was," he wept. "His badge was a bloody man, and he saw mine and made a jeep. Red man and pink maiden. Maybe they should get together. I drank to his Lord Bolton. He drank to Sir Mark, and we drank together to Lord Edmure and Lady Roslyn and the King in the North. And then he killed me."
His eyes were fever bright when he said that, and Arya could tell that it was true. His shoulder was swollen grotesquely, and pus and blood had stained his whole left side. There was a stink to him, too.
"He smells like a corpse."
The man begged them for a drink of wine.
"If I had any wine, I'd have drunk it myself," the hound told him. "I can give you water and the gift of mercy."
The archer looked at him a long while before he said,
"You're Joffrey's dog."
"My own dog now. Do you want the water?"
"Aye,"
the man swallowed.
"And the mercy, please."
They had passed a small pond a short ways back. Sandor gave Arya his helm and told her to fill it, so she trudged back to the water's edge. Mud squished over the toe of her boots. She used the dog's head as a pail. Water ran through the eye holes, but the bottom of the helm still held a lot. When she came back, the archer turned his face up, and she poured the water into his mouth. He gulped it down as fast as she could pour, and what he couldn't gulp ran down his cheeks into the brown blood that crusted his whiskers until pale pink tears dangled from his beard. When the water was gone, he clutched the helm and licked the steel.
"Good," he said. "I wish it was wine, though. I wanted wine."
"Me too."
The hound eased his dagger into the man's chest almost tenderly, the weight of his body driving the point through his surcoat ringmail and the quilting beneath. As he slid the blade back out and wiped it on the dead man, he looked at Arya.
"That's where the heart is, girl. That's how you kill a man."
"That's one way. Will we bury him?"
"Why?" Sandor said. "He don't care. and we got no spade. Leave him for the wolves and wild dogs, your brothers and mine.
He gave her a hard look.
First, we rub him, though.
There were 2 silver stags in the archer's purse and almost 30 coppers. His dagger had a pretty pink stone in the hilt. The hound hefted the knife in his hand, then flipped it toward Arya. She caught it by the hilt, slid it through her belt, and felt a little better. It wasn't needle, but it was steel. The dead man had a quiver of arrows, too, but arrows weren't much good without a bow. His boots were too big for Arya and too small for the hound, so those they left. She took his kettle helm as well, even though it came down almost past her nose, so she had to tilt it back to see.
He must have had a horse as well, or he wouldn't have gotten away, Clegane said, peering about. But it's bloody well gone, I'd say. No telling how long he's been here.
By the time they found themselves in the foothills of the Mountains of the Moon, the rains had mostly stopped. Arya could see the sun and moon and stars, and it seemed to her that they were heading eastward.
"Where are we going?"
she asked him.
This time the hound answered her. "You have an aunt in the area. Might be she'll want to ransom your scrawny ass, though the gods know why. Once we find the high road, we can follow it all the way to the bloody gate."
Aunt Lysa. The thought left Arya feeling empty. It was her mother she wanted, not her mother's sister. She didn't know her mother's sister any more than she knew her great-uncle, Blackfish. "We should have gone into the castle. They didn't really know that her mother was dead, or Rob either. It wasn't like they'd seen them die or anything. Maybe Lord Frey had just taken them captive. Maybe they were chained up in his dungeon, or maybe the Freys were taking them to King's Landing, so Joffrey could chop their heads off. They didn't know.
"We should go back," she suddenly decided. "We should go back to the twins and get my mother. She can't be dead. We have to help her."
"I thought your sister was the one with a head full of songs," the hound growled. "Frey might have kept your mother alive to ransom, that's true, but there's no way in 7 hells I'm going to pluck her out of his castle all by me bloody self."
"Not by yourself. I'd come too."
He made a sound that was almost a laugh.
"Ha! That will scare the piss out of the old man."
"You're just afraid to die," she said scornfully.
Now Clegane did laugh.
"Deaths don't scare me. Only fire. Now be quiet, or I'll cut your tongue out myself and save the Silent Sisters the bother. It's the veil for us."
Arya didn't think he'd really cut her tongue out. He was just saying that the way Pink Eye used to say he'd beat her bloody. All the same, she wasn't going to try him. Sandor Clegane was no Pink Eye. Pink Eye didn't cut people in half or hit them with axes. Not even with a flat of axes. That night she went to sleep thinking of her mother and wondering if she should kill the hound in his sleep and rescue Lady Catelyn herself. When she closed her eyes, she saw her mother's face against the back of her eyelids.
"She's so close, I could almost smell her."
And then she could smell her. The scent was faint beneath the other smells, beneath moss and mud and water and the stench of rotting reeds and rotting men. She padded slowly through the soft ground to the river's edge, lapped up a drink, then lifted her head to sniff. The sky was grey and thick with cloud, the river green and full of floating things. Dead men clogged the shallows, some still moving as the water pushed them, others washed up on the banks. Her brothers and sisters swarmed around them, tearing at the rich, ripe flesh. The crows were there too, screaming at the wolves and filling the air with feathers. Their blood was hotter, and one of her sisters had snapped at one as it took flight and caught it by the wing. It made her want a crow herself. She wanted to taste the blood, to hear the bones crunch between her teeth to fill her belly with warm flesh instead of cold. She was hungry, and the meat was all around, but she knew she could not eat. The scent was stronger now. She pricked her ears up and listened to the grumbles of her pack, the shriek of angry crows, the whir of wings, and sound of running water. Somewhere far off, she could hear horses and the calls of living men. But they were not what mattered. Only the scent mattered. She sniffed the air again. There it was. And now she saw it, too. Something pale and white, drifting down the river, turning where it brushed against the snag. The reeds bowed down before it. She splashed noisily through the shallows and threw herself into the deeper water, her legs churning. The current was strong, but she was stronger. She swam, following her nose. The river smells were rich and wet, but those were not the smells that pulled her. She paddled after the sharp red whisper of cold blood, the sweet, cloying stench of death. She chased them as she had often chased a red deer through the trees, and in the end she ran them down, her jaws closed around a pale white arm. She shook it to make it move, but there was only death and blood in her mouth. By now she was tiring, and it was all she could do to pull the body back to shore. As she dragged it up the muddy bank, one of her little brothers came prowling, his tongue lolling from his mouth. She had to snarl to drive him off, or else he would have fed. Only then did she stop to shake the water from her fur. The white thing lay face down in the mud, her dead flesh wrinkled and pale, cold blood trickling from her throat. "Rise," she thought. "Rise and eat and run with us." The sound of horses turned her head. Men. They were coming from downwind, so she had not smelled them, but now they were almost here. Men on horses, with flapping black and yellow and pink wings and long shiny claws in hand. Some of her younger brothers bared their teeth to defend the food they'd found, but she snapped at them until they scattered. That was the way of the wild. Deer and hares and crows fled before wolves, and wolves fled from men. She abandoned the cold white prize in the mud where she had dragged it and ran and felt no shame. When morning came, the hound did not need to shout at Arya or shake her awake. She had woken before him for a change and even watered the horses. They broke their fast in silence until Sandor said, "This thing about your mother." "It doesn't matter," Arya said in a dull voice. "I know she's dead. I saw her in a dream." The hound looked at her a long time, then nodded. No more was said of it. They rode on toward the mountains. In the higher hills, they came upon a tiny, isolated village, surrounded by grey-green sentinels and tall blue soldier pines, and Clegane decided to risk going in. "We need food," he said, "and a roof over our heads. They're not like to know what happened at the Twins, and with any luck, they won't know me." The villagers were building a wooden palisade around their homes, and when they saw the breadth of the hound's shoulders, they offered them food and shelter and even coin for work. "If there's wine as well, I'll do it," he growled at them. In the end, he settled for ale and drank himself to sleep each night. His dream of selling Arya to Lady Arryn died there in the hills, though.
"There's frost above us and snow in the hay passes," the village elder said. "If you don't freeze or starve, the shadow cats will get you, or the Keeve bears. There's the clans as well. The burned men are fearless since Timmit 1A came back from the war. And half a year ago, Gunther, son of Gurn, led the Stone Crows down on a village not 8 miles from here. They took every woman and every scrap of grain and killed half the men. They have steel now, good swords and mail hauberks, and they watch the Hay Road, the Stone Crows, the Milk Sneaks, the Sons of the Mist, all of them. Might be you'd take a few with you, but in the end they'd kill you and make off with your daughter.
I am not his daughter,
Arya might have shouted, if she hadn't felt so tired. She was no one's daughter now. She was no one. Not Arya, not Weasel, not Nan, nor Arry, nor Squab, not even Lumpyhead. She was only some girl who ran with a dog by day and dreamed of wolves by night. It was quiet in the village. They had beds stuffed with straw and not too many lice. The food was plain but filling, and the air smelled of pines. All the same, Arya soon decided that she hated it. The villagers were cowards. None of them would even look at the hound's face, at least not for long. Some of the women tried to put her in a dress and make her do needlework, but they weren't Lady Smallwood, and she was having none of it. And there was one girl who took to following her, the village elder's daughter. She was of an age with Arya, but just a child. She cried if she skinned a knee and carried a stupid cloth doll with her everywhere she went. The doll was made up to look like a man-at-arms, sort of. So the girl called him Sir Soldier and bragged how he kept her safe. "Go away," Arya told her half 100 times. "Just leave me be." She wouldn't, though. So finally, Arya took the doll away from her, ripped it open, and pulled the rag stuffing out of its belly with a finger. "Now he really looks like a soldier," she said, before she threw the doll in a brook. After that, the girl stopped pestering her, and Arya spent her days grooming Craven and Stranger or walking in the woods. Sometimes she would find a stick and practice her needlework. But then she would remember what had happened at the twins and smash it against a tree until it broke. "Might be we should stay here a while," the hound told her after a fortnight. He was drunk on ale, but more brooding than sleepy. "We'd never reach the area, and afraid we'll still be hunting survivors in the Riverlands. Sounds like they need swords here, with these clansmen raiding. We can rest up, maybe find a way to get a letter to your aunt." Arya's face darkened when she heard that. She didn't want to stay, but there was nowhere to go either. The next morning, when the hound went off to chop down trees and haul logs, she crawled back into bed. But when the work was done and the tall wooden palisade finished, the village elder made it plain that there was no place for them.
"Come winter, we will be hard-pressed to feed our own," he explained. "And you, a man like you, brings blood with him."
Sandor's mouth tightened. "So, you know who I am?"
"Aye, we don't get travellers here, that's so, but we go to market and to fairs. We know about King Joffrey's dog."
"When these Stone Crows come calling, you might be glad to have a dog."
"Might be."
The man hesitated, then gathered up his courage.
"But they say you lost your belly for fighting at the Blackwater. They say—"
"I know what they say." Sandor's voice sounded like two wood saws grinding together. "Pay me, and we'll be gone." When they left, the hound had a pouch full of coppers, a skin of sour ale, and a new sword. It was a very old sword, if truth be told, though new to him. He swapped its owner the long axe he'd taken at the twins, the one he'd used to raise the lump on Arya's head. The ale was gone in less than a day, but Clegane sharpened the sword every night, cursing the man he'd swapped with for every nick and spot of rust.
"If he lost his belly for fighting, why does he care if his sword is sharp?"
It was not a question Arya dared ask him, but she thought on it a lot. Was that why he'd run from the twins and carried her off? Back in the Riverlands, they found that the rains had ebbed away and the floodwaters had begun to recede. The hound turned south, back toward the Trident. will make for River Run, he told Arya as they roasted a hare he'd killed. Maybe the Blackfish wants to buy himself a she-wolf.
He doesn't know me. He won't even know I'm really me.
Arya was tired of making for River Run. She had been making for River Run for years, it seemed, without ever getting there. Every time she made for River Run, she ended up someplace worse.
He won't give you any ransom. He'll probably just hang you.
He's free to try.
He turned the spit.
He doesn't talk like he's lost his belly for fighting.
I know where we could go, Arya said. She still had one brother left.
Jon will want me, even if no one else does. He'll call me Little Sister and muss my hair.
It was a long way, though, and she didn't think she could get there by herself. She hadn't even been able to reach River Run.
We could go to the wall.
Sandor's laugh was half a growl.
The little wolf bitch wants to join the Night's Watch, does she?
My brother's on the wall, she said stubbornly.
His mouth gave a twitch. The wall's 1,000 leagues from here. We need to fight through the bloody frays just to reach the neck. There's lizard lions in those swamps that eat wolves every day for breakfast. And if we did reach the north with our skins intact, there's ironborn in half the castles and thousands of bloody buggering Northmen as well.
Are you scared of them? She asked. Have you lost your belly for fighting?
For a moment she thought he was going to hit her. By then the hair was brown, though, skin crackling and grease popping as it dripped down into the cook fire. Sandor took it off the stick, ripped it apart with his big hands, and tossed half of it into Arya's lap.
There's nothing wrong with my belly,
he said as he pulled off a leg.
But I don't give a rat's arse for you or your brother. I have a brother too.
Cersei. On the last night of her imprisonment, the queen could not sleep. Each time she closed her eyes, her head filled with forebodings and fantasies of the morrow. I will have guards, she told herself.
They will keep the crowds away. No one will be allowed to touch me.
The High Sparrow had promised her that much. Even so, she was afraid. On the day Marcella sailed for Dawn, the day of the bread riots, gold cloaks had been posted all along the route of the procession, but the mob had broken through their lines to tear the old fat High Septon into pieces and rape Lolly Stokeworth 50 times. And if that pale, soft, stupid creature could incite the animals when fully clothed, how much more lust would a queen inspire? Cersei paced her cell, restless as the caged lions that had lived in the bowels of Casterly Rock when she was a girl, a legacy of her grandfather's time. She and Jaime used to dare each other to climb into their cage, and once she worked up enough courage to slip her hand between two bars and touch one of the great tawny beasts. She was always bolder than her brother. The lion had turned his head to stare at her with huge golden eyes. Then he licked her fingers. His tongue was as rough as a rasp, but even so she would not pull her hand back, not until Jaime took her by the shoulders and yanked her away from the cage.
"Your turn," she told him afterward. "Pull his mane, I dare you."
He never did. I should have had the sword, not him. Barefoot and shivering, she paced, a thin blanket draped about her shoulders. She was anxious for the day to come. By evening, it would all be done.
A little walk and I'll be home. I'll be back with Tommen in my own chambers, inside Maegor's holdfast.
Her uncle said it was the only way to save herself. Was it, though? She could not trust her uncle, no more than she trusted this High Septon.
I could still refuse. I could still insist upon my innocence and hazard all upon a trial.
But she dare not let the faith sit in judgment on her, as that Marjorie Tyrell meant to do. That might serve the little Rose well enough, but Cersei had few friends amongst the scepters and sparrows around this new High Septon. Her only hope was trial by battle, and for that she must needs have a champion. If Jamie had not lost his hand. That road led nowhere, though. Jamie's sword hand was gone, and so was he, vanished with the woman Brienne, somewhere in the Riverlands. The queen had to find another defender, or today's ordeal would be the least of her travails. Her enemies were accusing her of treason. She had to reach Tommen, no matter the costs.
"He loves me. He will not refuse his own mother. Joff was stubborn and unpredictable, but Tommen is a good little boy, a good little king. He will do as he's told."
If she stayed here, she was doomed, and the only way she would return to the Red Keep was by walking. The High Sparrow had been adamant, and Sir Kevin refused to lift a finger against him. "No harm will come to me today," Cersei said, when the day's first light brushed her window. "Only my pride will suffer." The words rang hollow in her ears.
"Jamie may yet come."
She pictured him riding through the morning mist, his golden armour bright in the light of the rising sun.
"Jamie, if you ever loved me."
When her jailers came for her, Scepter Yunella, Scepter Moel, and Scepter Scalera led the procession. With them were four novices and two of the Silent Sisters. The sight of the Silent Sisters in their grey robes filled the queen with sudden terrors.
"Why are they here? Am I to die?"
The Silent Sisters attended to the dead.
"The High Septon promised that no harm would come to me."
"Nor will it."
Scepter Yunella beckoned to the novices. They brought lye soap, a basin of warm water, a pair of shears, and a long, straight razor. The sight of the steel sent a shiver through her.
"They mean to shave me. A little more humiliation, a raisin for my porridge."
She would not give them the pleasure of hearing her beg.
"I am Cersei of House Lannister, a Lion of the Rock, the rightful queen of these seven kingdoms, true-born daughter of Tywin Lannister. And hair grows back.
Get on with it," she said. The elder of the two Silent Sisters took up the shears. A practiced barber, no doubt. Her order often cleaned the corpses of the noble slain before returning them to their kin. And trimming beards and cutting hair was part of that. The woman bared the queen's head first. Cersei sat as still as a stone statue as the shears clicked. Drifts of golden hair fell to the floor. She had not been allowed to tend it properly, penned up in a cell, but even unwashed and tangled, it shone where the sun touched it. "My crown," the queen thought. "They took the other crown away from me, and now they are stealing this one as well." When her locks and curls were piled up around her feet, one of the novices soaped her head, and the Silent Sister scraped away the stubble with a razor. Cersei hoped that would be the end of it. But no.
"Remove your shift, your grace," Scepter Yunella commanded.
"Here?" the queen asked.
"Why?" "You must be shorn."
"Shorn?" she thought, "like a sheep." She yanked the shift over her head and tossed it to the floor.
"Do what you will."
Then it was the soap again, the warm water, and the razor. The hair beneath her arms went next, then her legs, and last of all the fine golden down that covered her mound. When the Silent Sister crept between her legs with a razor, Cersei found herself remembering all the times that Jamie had knelt where she was kneeling now, planting kisses on the inside of her thighs, making her wet. His kisses were always warm. The razor was ice cold. When the deed was done, she was as naked and vulnerable as a woman could be.
Not even a hair to hide behind.
A little laugh burst from her lips, bleak and bitter.
Does your grace find this amusing?
Said Scepter Scalera. No, Scepter, said Circe. But one day I will have your tongue ripped out with hot pincers, and that will be hilarious. One of the novices had brought a robe for her, a soft white Scepter's robe, to cover her as she made her way down the tower steps and through the sept, so any worshippers they met along the way might be spared the sight of naked flesh. Seven save us all. What hypocrites they are.
Will I be permitted a pair of sandals? She asked. The streets are filthy.
Not so filthy as your sins, said Scepter Moel. His High Holiness has commanded that you present yourself as the gods made you. Did you have sandals on your feet when you came forth from your lady mother's womb?
No, Scepter, the queen was forced to say.
Then you have your answer.
A bell began to toll. The queen's long imprisonment was at an end. Circe pulled the robe tighter, grateful for its warmth, and said, Let us go. Her son awaited her across the city. The sooner she set out, the sooner she would see him. The rough stone of the steps scraped her soles as Circe Lannister made her descent. She had come to Baelor's Sept a queen, riding in a litter. She was leaving, bald and barefoot. But I am leaving. That is all that matters. The tower bells were singing, summoning the city to bear witness to her shame. The great sept of Baelor was crowded with faithful come for the dawn service, the sound of their prayers echoing off the dome overhead. But when the queen's procession made its appearance, a sudden silence fell, and a thousand eyes turned to follow her as she made her way down the aisle, past the place where her lord father had lain in state after his murder. Circe swept by them, looking neither right nor left. Her bare feet slapped against the cold marble floor. She could feel the eyes. Behind their altars, the seven seemed to watch as well. In the Hall of Lamps, a dozen warriors' sons awaited her coming. Rainbow cloaks hung down their backs, and the crystals that crested their great helms glittered in the lamplight. Their armour was silver plate, polished to a mirror sheen, but underneath, she knew, every man of them wore a hair shirt. Their kite shields all bore the same device, a crystal sword shining in the darkness, the ancient badge of those the small folk called swords. Their captain knelt before her. Perhaps your grace will recall me. I am Sir Theodan the True, and his High Holiness has given me command of your escort. My brothers and I will see you safely through the city. Cersei's gaze swept across the faces of the men behind him, and there he was, Lancel, her cousin, Sir Kevin's son, who had once professed to love her before he decided that he loved the gods more. My blood and my betrayer. She would not forget him. You may rise, Sir Theodan. I am ready. The knight stood, turned, raised a hand. Two of his men stepped to the towering doors and pushed them open, and Circe walked through them into the open air, blinking at the sunlight like a mole roused from its burrow. A gusty wind was blowing, and it set the bottom of her robe snapping and flapping at her legs. The morning air was thick with the old familiar stinks of King's Landing. She breathed in the scents of sour wine, bread baking, rotting fish and night soil, smoke and sweat and horse piss. No flower had ever smelt so sweet. Huddled in her robe, Circe paused atop the marble steps as the warrior's sons formed up around her. It came to her suddenly that she had stood in this very spot before, on the day Lord Eddard Stark had lost his head. That was not supposed to happen. Joff was supposed to spare his life and send him to the wall. Stark's elder son would have followed him as Lord of Winterfell, but Sansa would have stayed at court, a hostage. Varys and Littlefinger had worked out the terms, and Ned Stark had swallowed his precious honour and confessed his treason to save his daughter's empty little head. I would have made Sansa a good marriage. A Lannister marriage. Not Joff, of course, but Lancel might have suited, or one of his younger brothers. Peter Baelish had offered to wed the girl himself, she recalled. But, of course, that was impossible. He was much too low-born. If Joff had only done as he was told, Winterfell would never have gone to war, and father would have dealt with Robert's brothers. Instead, Joff had commanded that Stark's head be struck off, and Lord Slint and Sir Ilan Payne had hastened to obey. It was just there, the Queen recalled, gazing at the spot. Jaina Slint had lifted Ned Stark's head by the hair as his life's blood flowed down the steps, and after that there was no turning back. The memories seemed so distant. Joffrey was dead, and all Stark's sons as well. Even her father had perished. And here she stood, on the steps of the great sept again. Only this time, it was her the mob was staring at, not Eddard Stark. The wide marble plaza below was as crowded as it had been on the day that Stark had died. Everywhere she looked, the Queen saw eyes. The mob seemed to be equal parts men and women. Some had children on their shoulders, beggars and thieves, tavern keepers and trade folk, tanners and stable boys and mummers, the poorer sort of whore. All the scum had come out to see a queen brought low. And mingled in with them were the poor fellows, filthy, unshaven creatures, armed with spears and axes and clad in bits of dinted plate, rusted mail and cracked leather, under rough-spun surcoats bleached white and blazoned with the seven-pointed star of the faith. The High Sparrow's ragged army. Part of her still yearned for Jaime to appear and rescue her from this humiliation. But her twin was nowhere to be seen, nor was her uncle present. That did not surprise her. Sir Kevin had made his views plain during his last visit. Her shame must not be allowed to tarnish the honour of Casterly Rock. No lions would walk with her today. This ordeal was hers, and hers alone. Scepter Yunella stood to her right, Scepter Moel to her left, Scepter Scalera behind her. If the Queen should bolt or balk, the three hags would drag her back inside, and this time they would see to it that she never left her cell. Cersei raised her head. Beyond the plaza, beyond the sea of hungry eyes and gaping mouths and dirty faces across the city, Aegon's high hill rose in the distance, the towers and battlements of the Red Keep blushing pink in the light of the rising sun. It is not so far. Once she reached its gates, the worst of her travails would be over. She would have her son again. She would have her champion. Her uncle had promised her. Tommen is waiting for me, my little king. I can do this. I must. Scepter Yunella stepped forward. A sinner comes before you, she declared. She is Cersei of House Lannister, Queen Dowager, mother to his grace King Tommen, widow of his grace King Robert, and she has committed grievous falsehoods and fornications. Scepter Moel moved up to the Queen's right. This sinner has confessed her sins and begged for absolution and forgiveness. His High Holiness has commanded her to demonstrate her repentance by putting aside all pride and artifice and presenting herself as the God's Maiden before the good people of the city. Scepter Scalera finished.
So now this sinner comes before you with a humble heart, shorn of secrets and concealments, naked before the eyes of gods and men, to make her walk of atonement.
Cersei had been a year old when her grandfather died. The first thing her father had done on his accession was to expel his own father's grasping, low-born mistress from Casterly Rock. The silks and velvets Lord Titus had lavished on her, and the jewellery she had taken for herself, had been stripped from her, and she had been sent forth naked to walk through the streets of Lannisport, so the West could see her for what she was. Though she had been too young to witness the spectacle herself, Cersei had heard the stories growing up from the mouths of washerwomen and guardsmen who had been there. They spoke of how the woman had wept and begged, of the desperate way she clung to her garments when she was commanded to disrobe, of her futile efforts to cover her breasts and her sex with her hands as she hobbled barefoot and naked through the streets to exile. "Vain and proud she was before," she remembered one guard saying. "So haughty, you think she'd forgot she'd come from dirt. Once we got her clothes off her, though, she was just another whore." If Sir Kevin and the High Sparrow thought that it would be the same with her, they were very much mistaken. Lord Tywin's blood was in her. "I am a lioness. I will not cringe for them." The queen shrugged off her robe. She bared herself in one smooth, unhurried motion, as if she were back in her own chambers, disrobing for her bath with no one but her bedmaids looking on. When the cold wind touched her skin, she shivered violently. It took all her strength of will not to try and hide herself with her hands, as her grandfather's whore had done. Her fingers tightened into fists, her nails digging into her palms. They were looking at her, all the hungry eyes. But what were they seeing? "I am beautiful," she reminded herself. How many times had Jamie told her that? Even Robert had given her that much when he came to her bed in his cups to pay her drunken homage with his cock. They looked at Ned Stark the same way, though. She had to move. Naked, shorn, barefoot, Cersei made a slow descent down the broad marble steps. Goose prickles rose on her arms and legs. She held her chin high, as a queen should, and her escort fanned out ahead of her. The poor fellows shoved men aside to open a way through the crowd, whilst the swords fell in on either side of her. Septa Eunella, Septa Scalera, and Septa Moel followed. Behind them came the novice girls in white. "Whore!" someone cried out, a woman's voice. Women were always the cruelest where other women were concerned. Cersei ignored her. "There will be more and worse. These creatures have no sweeter joy in life than jeering at their betters." She could not silence them, so she must pretend she did not hear them. She would not see them either. She would keep her eyes on Aegon's high hill across the city, on the towers of the Red Keep shimmering in the light. That was where she would find her salvation, if her uncle had kept his part of their bargain. "He wanted this, him and the High Sparrow, and the Little Rose as well, I do not doubt. I have sinned and must atone, must parade my shame before the eyes of every beggar in the city. They think that this will break my pride, that it will make an end to me. But they are wrong." Septa Eunella and Septa Moel kept pace with her, with Septa Scalera scurrying behind, ringing a bell. "Shame!" the old hag called. "Shame upon the sinner! Shame! Shame!" Somewhere off to the right, another voice sang counterpoint to hers, some baker's boy shouting, "Meat pies! 3 pence! Up, meat pies, here!" The marble underfoot was cold and slippery, and Cersei had to step carefully for fear of slipping. Their path took them past the statue of Baelor the Blessed, standing tall and serene upon his plinth, his face a study in benevolence. To look at him, you would never guess what a fool he'd been. The Targaryen dynasty
had produced kings both bad and good, but none as beloved as Balor. That pious, gentle Septon king, who loved the small folk and the gods in equal parts, yet imprisoned his own sisters.